This is Faith in Action, the program that looks at how people put their faith into action in their everyday lives. Faith in Action is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Now here's today's program.
That is not exactly your normal intro for Faith in Action, but this isn't going to be a normal show.
We're going
to be talking about the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. I'm Kent Blanford. Alongside me, Bridget Eyre.
Yeah.
And sitting across the table from us, Michael Petrie.
Yes, and Michael is the executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. And welcome to Faith in Action. Thanks for being my guest.
It's great to be with you.
Yeah, and the big concert, there's a big event coming up. It's coming up Saturday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. It's a one show only, and it's called Sacred Masterworks. What a perfect title for music like that.
Isn't that the truth? So the tradition of choral music in the United States, certainly there's sacred and secular alike, but so much of the music written for the human voice, perhaps one of the most intimate and personal expressions of creativity, of art, of faith, of values, of belief, is sung, right?
Absolutely.
And so much of what the symphonic choir does is sacred in some nature, whether it's a setting of the Mass, a setting of Psalms, a setting of Scripture, but of course poetry and so many other inspired works of art can be sacred and interpreted sacredly as well by the listener, by the consumer.
Well, you know, when I found out that I was going to be doing this interview with you, and I thought, wow, I don't really know what a symphonic choir is. I mean, I had to really think about that. What is a symphonic choir, and how is that different from other types of choirs?
Oh my gosh, what a great question. So think of a symphonic choir as not just a great chorus of perhaps 20 or 30 singers, but of something like, oh, a couple hundred singers.
Wow.
So yeah, we're talking
size,
an enormous choir, right?
Uh-huh.
The symphonic choir here in Indianapolis is about 200 voices. And they're all adults. These are adult singers.
That was my next question.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, they're all volunteer, actually, as well. They have to audition every year and re-audition once they're in it. So it's pretty competitive. But it's...
You have to compete for a volunteer
slot.
That's really...
Isn't that incredible?
That's really wonderful, actually.
These singers are hugely talented, but also highly dedicated as well. It's about 200 hours a year per singer of volunteer time. So it's... Quite honestly, it's a way of life.
Yeah.
But aside from the choir, what makes up the choir, the 200-some singers, it's the repertoire that they sing. The vast majority of repertoire written for a symphonic chorus in the United States or elsewhere in Western culture is for large chorus and orchestra.
Okay.
So a choir could sing a cappella, of course, right? No accompaniment. Or they could sing with a piano or any other form of accompaniment. But symphonic choruses traditionally are accompanied by a rather large orchestra as well to match the rather large chorus.
And what I always feel is so exciting about seeing a performance like this is there's so much action. There's so much going on. I mean, really, there's all the instruments and there's so much to look at and listen to. It's incredibibly exciting as a person in the audience.
It's almost a spectacle, right?
It really is.
You can watch the violins and the bows moving in sync, in tandem together, or you can watch the trumpet or the trombone, let alone 200 voices on stage, and the conductor trying to, well, certainly admirably corralling everybody and swimming in the same direction. Yeah, it's a lot to watch, let alone to listen to.
Something that impressed me about the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir when I was looking into a little bit of the background is how long the choir has been around. Can you talk about that?
It's the choir's 81st season, this year that we're in the midst of.
And I was really shocked when I saw that. I thought, oh my gosh, my husband and I were laughing about, well, I wonder if there's some original members that might still be alive. They have to be really old, but you know.
We do have a couple friends of the choir who remember when the choir was founded, but at this point, they're not singing in the choir, right. No.
People are living longer these days, though, the truth. You know, so.
I think we have a range in the choir of singers. Our choir is actually a fairly young choir compared to a lot of symphonic choruses nationally, which is great. Young in terms of the people in the choir.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of folks just out of high school who are in college and singing. They want this opportunity. And a number of people kind of up until that age when you have kids and your entire life is focused on the kiddos, right?
I wouldn't know anything
right?
about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we're all aware of that. So we have a lot of younger folks in the choir, which is really great. But you ask about the age of the institution. 81 years puts us older than most symphonic choirs around the country. That's exactly right.
So if you're just joining us right now, I'm here with Michael Petrie, who is the executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, and we are actually talking about an upcoming concert called Sacred Masterworks, which is going to be at the, tell me the name of the...
At the Schrott Center, which is located just next to Clues Hall,
right,
on the Butler University campus. It's a relatively new space, actually.
And it's February 3rd at 7 p.m. And we're actually going to listen to another music selection here. Let's listen to He Is Watching Over Israel. What was that song about? We were just pondering that.
Isn't that beautiful?
It really is. Very beautiful.
Yeah. Well, it's an excerpt from Mendelssohn's Elijah. So the story of Elijah that so many of us are familiar with, Mendelssohn set 250 years ago or so to music. And it's a large work, verging on 2 hours. And the story of Elijah for chorus, orchestra and multiple soloists. It's basically the story coming off the page and coming to life. So that's one of the movements of that about 2 hour larger work.
So what all is involved in putting producing a choral orchestra works like these?
What's the old joke? Practice, 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 or something like that, right?
Yeah, I think it is.
How do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you what. The kudos go out to the singers and the symphonic choir because this is a way of life for them. This is hours and hours of rehearsal, as I mentioned a bit ago, usually about 6 to 8 weeks prior to the curtain going up on a performance. Mm-hmm. The singers and Eric Stark, who is our conductor and artistic director, begin rehearsing a piece. But even prior to that, about 24 months to 2.5 years ahead, Eric is selecting the music that will be performed. It takes a lot of time, of course, and money that needs to be fundraised to bring these pieces to life. These are large pieces. And, of course, renting the hall and rehearsal space that can physically accommodate that many singers can be a challenge. And so about 6 or 8 weeks before the downbeat of the show, the singers start really digging into the rehearsal. And I'll tell you what, it's 3 hours a week every Tuesday evening, and then production week right before the show, of course. Mm-hmm. It's every single night of the week, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night, for 4 hours a night. So they don't see their family for that week.
It's very, very intense. Anyone that's been in a production, I used to be in musicals. My daughter's in Carmel High School Marching Band, which that's, you know,
That's
pretty
a
high caliber.
That is a major commitment.
It is a major commitment. I think it's about 40 hours a week, honestly.
And such talent, too, in the ensemble.
Yeah, right. And last 2 years they won the national grand champion. I couldn't help but say that, but I know what goes into.
And it's the whole family, isn't it? It's not just in the case of your child or a spouse in the symphonic choir. It's really an entire way of life for the family, which makes it even more of a great family experience also.
Absolutely. Now, there are a couple, talk about what is going to be performed. Those two pieces that we heard coming into the show and just here a little bit ago, those pieces are not going to be performed, but what is going to be performed?
That's exactly right. The two pieces that we heard earlier in this show are prior installations for the Symphonic Choir's Sacred Masterworks series. But what you'll hear in just about a week or so.
This is an annual event,
it's an annual
right?
series, that showcases different works for chorus and orchestra that are sacred in nature. The two works that you'll hear on February 3rd performed live, one is by Stravinsky, so a 20th century composer, and it's a setting of the psalm text, which of course is a text in three of the Abrahamic traditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this worldly, timeless text when you think about the psalms. The messages still ring true today after generations and generations and generations.
Absolutely. It's timeless.
It is.
It really is. I read it, I think, wow, this is going on right now.
It still applies to me right this moment.
No doubt.
So it's called Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms. And so a symphony is, we think of a symphony as normally an orchestra, right? With strings and trumpets and woodwinds and all of that. Well, the composer, Igor Stravinsky, decided to add chorus to this symphony. And wait for it, he got rid of the violins and violas. So no violins and violas in a symphony. And we're going, what? What was this guy thinking?
Isn't that a marching band?
Right. Yeah. Is this a wind ensemble or something now?
That's
and
hilarious.
He added a second piano because one isn't enough, I guess, right?
Okay.
He added a second piano and the chorus, and they fulfill the role of the violins and the violas. So the chorus, in essence, becomes a part of the symphony, adding that color and that texture that we would expect from a symphony. So that's one of the two pieces.
Okay.
And it's a brief work. It's about 15 minutes. It's not very long.
That seems forever. But we'll talk about that,
too.
Yeah,
we'll talk about how pieces evolve a little bit over time, right?
Yeah.
The length of them. And then the other piece is by Ralph Vaughan Williams, who, a 20th century English composer. And it's a setting of Grant Us Peace, Dona Nobis Pacem. So the Latin text from the Mass that many of us know, combined with poetry by Walt Whitman that was composed. Walt Whitman was a nurse during the Civil War, and so it's text that was inspired by his experience, very trying experience, of course, serving during the Civil War.
Well, we are going to take a break here, and we'll be back with Michael Petrie of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir here shortly.
The Indianapolis Symphony Choir presents two sacred masterworks on February 3rd at the Schwartz Center at Butler University. Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms and Vaughan Williams' Dona Nobis Pacem, a peaceful, hopeful composition featuring the 150-voice Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, orchestra, and world-class soloist. More information and tickets, beginning at $25, are available at indychoir.org. That's indychoir.org for more information.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
Welcome back to Faith in Action. I'm Kent Blanford, along with Bridget Ayer. We are talking with Michael Petrie about the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir and their upcoming event at the Schwartz Center on the campus of Butler University coming up Saturday, February 3rd. Lots of great things in the Sacred Masterworks.
And we were actually talking about a couple of the pieces that are going to be performed. Could you talk some more about where we were at when we left off last?
Sure thing. So we talked a little bit about Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms in this psalm setting. And I should mention, we have now performed for the past two seasons, and this is the third season, a different setting of the psalms each year. You heard a little bit of an excerpt in the beginning, mm-hmm. here in the beginning of this broadcast, mm-hmm. in fact,
so
coincidentally,
so, yes.
Uh-huh, which was from a piece that we commissioned a couple years ago, a setting of the Psalms, set in English and Arabic.
Mm.
And then we performed last year a setting of the Psalms by Leonard Bernstein,
mm-hmm.
in Hebrew. And so this year we're singing a setting of the Psalms in the Latin Vulgate, so the sacred language for many of us that we're familiar with.
Absolutely.
And it's this kind of triptych or this trilogy that salutes and honors the Psalms in this tradition of singing the Psalms around the world for many years. So the other piece, go ahead.
And we were joking about, you know, how the Psalms are so timeless, and mm-hmm. I went and listened to this particular one because I wasn't familiar with it, and it was so somber. I had to see in the beginning, not in the beginning song,
right.
but in the beginning of the song, and I thought I had to know what was going on. So I'm looking it up, and I'm like, I found the Latin. I'm like, well, I don't speak Latin, so I read the text, and
right.
the first one is a penitent suffering plea for healing, and it that emotion mm-hmm. came out so much in the
yeah.
music.
You feel it, right?
You really do.
Stravinsky, the composer of that piece, was very religious, and he wasn't overly outward with his faith, but he was deeply committed to the faith. And so this was a very personal piece for him, certainly, this composition that he wrote.
You know, traditionally, many of the Psalms lend themselves beautifully mm-hmm. to musical settings in the fact that many of them start off as the lament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here is my situation, but then they end up, you know, going, in. If you're talking musical terms, you're going from the minor key mm. and finishing in the major with, yes, I have these issues and these problems in my life, but I have God.
Right, right. That's a really good comparison from that minor to the major, as you say.
And then, yeah, there is a happy ending of the Psalms here. It's let all things praise the Lord. And obviously the tone is going to change.
Hallelujah.
It's going to get really, really, get really rocking there.
It's beautiful. You know, if I could sum up that piece in perhaps one word, I would say reverent. As you listen to that, doesn't that word just come to mind? It's a reverent
yeah.
experience. And whatever somebody's bringing from their life, you know, in the outside world, I think they will come and sit in that audience and feel something special and perhaps otherworldly. I think they could be prepared for a little bit of an escape from all the noise everywhere.
Absolutely. It'll be a special
experience.
Music just has a way of transporting us to mm. another place and time, you know, whether it's music like this, where it really is of another time in mm-hmm. a sense, or to you hear a contemporary song and you go back in time to, you know, your high school years or whatever, you know, it kind of has that. I was really reflecting on really the impact of music on our lives.
That's exactly right. And I think the text too, it's the music, but when they put together different texts, like for example, the other piece, the Dona Nobis Pacem, the music itself by Ralph Vaughan Williams is stunning. And if we were just humming that or singing it on Lou or something, it would certainly be beautiful. But he sets it with text from, as I mentioned, the Mass, plus poetry by Walt Whitman. The poetry itself is powerful, right? We study and we use Whitman in much of our life for reflection, for inspiration. We can turn to it for a little bit of a challenge at times. Mm-hmm. And so he sets these powerful texts to powerful music, which is some sort of incredible duo to even think, I suspect, of pairing those texts and music together. When this piece, the Dona Nobis Pacem, Grant Us Peace, was written, World War I had been finished, but people could tell what was on the horizon just around the corner, certainly in Europe. Mm-hmm. And Vaughan Williams, English, he could see firsthand what was coming. And I think he was very conflicted. He was in a hard position. Just survived one war, right? And I think that's part of why he selected some of the text by Whitman, who served in the Civil War and wrote much of his text inspired by his very graphic images that he saw on the battlefield. And so it's a song about peace. It's a song about hope. It's a song about love that I think it's, again, as we were saying, timeless.
Yes, so much. And when we think about, well, you know what? I was thinking, what do you have a favorite piece in all, you know, all these various music that you hear? I mean, do you have like a favorite?
Of these two pieces, there's a movement called Beat, Beat, Drums. And it's from the Vaughan Williams, from the second piece we've been talking about, Dona Nobis Pacem. And it's the sound, beat, beat, drums. It's the sound of the caissons rolling along of a funeral dirge, of a funeral march, in essence. And it is incredibly poignant. Whether somebody has recently lost, perhaps, a loved one, or is being touched in their own life by something very trying, this is a very sacred, somber moment, which is important. It's important to be celebratory sometimes, and in much of life, and grateful. It's also important to pause and to reflect on what's really trying us, isn't it? And not just to gloss over that, but to really sit with it for a little bit and understand why we're feeling the way we're feeling. And that movement to me, beat, beat, drums, really evokes that emotion.
And music is such a language unto itself. It's just, I've really, really always thought that, but in listening to these pieces just recently, I thought, wow, it's just completely different. And the other question I have is, why are the length of these pieces versus, you know, contemporary music, you know, you get a 2-minute song or whatever.
Right.
I mean, I just, you know, we got the Catholic jukebox host here, you know, Kent with us.
I will contribute to this. I'll simply say attention spans.
Well, that might be part of it. But no, I mean, in terms of the composition of the works, is it because it's the genre, the time period? What is it?
Wow, that's a great question. We could take about an hour and a half to really dig into this. Sounds like a doctoral thesis.
No.
Kind of at the top level, you've hit on something exactly right. Take the Symphony of Psalms by Stravinsky that we were talking about. It's about a 15-minute work, give or take. And each movement is approximately 5 minutes. There are three movements in it. So when you think of it like that, a 5-minute song is on the longer side, certainly, compared to maybe a Chris Tomlin or something we may listen to today.
Sure.
But that's still going to be 3.5, maybe 4 minutes or so. So the Symphony of Psalms is, in this case, let's say 3 songs that are put together into one piece.
Right.
And the Vaughan Williams, the other piece, is a multi-movement work with a lot of different movements, which we could think of as songs, being put together into one package. You know, Handel's Messiah, which we hear at the Christmas time a lot, right?
Yeah.
Or sometimes during Holy Week, but mostly during the Christmas period, it's almost a 3-hour work when you include the intermission. Right. That's a long piece written in the 1700s. But it's made up of smaller movements that are as short as 1 minute up to 3 or 4 minutes of each movement.
So I want to talk about, okay, so the event that we're coming up with is the Sacred Masterworks. It's Saturday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. It's only a one show only. And I want to talk about the venue. It's the at the Howard Schrott Center at Butler University. Talk about the venue. I mean, people know about Clues Hall there at mm-hmm. Butler. Talk about the new Schrott Center.
If somebody hasn't been yet, the performance will be stunning. Period.
Of course.
No question about that. I think they may also just enjoy in the hall a little bit. What I would recommend, get there a little bit early, get there 15 minutes earlier than somebody might normally, and take some time to poke around the venue. It's beautiful. So first of all, for context, the Schrott Center is right next to Clues Hall. Most
okay.
of us have been to Clues Hall.
Yeah.
It's built right next to it, so it's really easy to locate. Secondly, visually, the architecture is just really interesting, very modern, but not in a stark or cold way.
Mm-hmm.
They somehow made this a very inviting space.
Mm-hmm.
One little tidbit for everybody, and you can impress your friends at your next party that you're attending.
Okay.
Remember this one. The stage at Clues Hall, so where the performers will be sitting and standing, is just about the exact same size as Clues Hall right next door. And yet the audience, where all the seats are of the Schrott Center, seats just under 500 compared to Clues seats just over 2,000. So the audience at the Schrott Center gets this truly intimate performance. It feels like they're almost performing it just for me.
Yeah.
It's an incredible venue.
That is really neat. And I didn't really think about that. Now, let's see how much time do we have. Okay, so give us some more details about how you get the tickets and that kind of
right.
details.
Well, you mentioned it's a one night only. So,
yes.
So what I do encourage folks to do is, first of all, go on to indiechoir.org, the
okay.
Symphonic Choir's website. That's the easiest place to get tickets at indiechoir.org. And you can select your own seats there. So as I said, the venue is a lovely venue. There are no bad seats. But some people, if you're like me,
mm-hmm.
I prefer to sit in the front half of the house rather than the back half. Not that the back half is bad.
And I like the back.
See,
I just
right,
prefer
exactly.
the back.
Just different perspectives.
Yeah.
And they're all great. So they could go onto the website and get tickets there. There may be some tickets available on the night of the show if they come to the box office a little bit early, but I hate to recommend that to people if they're making plans or dinner or whatever it could be.
Right.
You know, the day just gets away from folks.
You don't want to get there and then it's sold out.
That's right.
You know.
So this is, as you mentioned, the Sacred Masterworks concert really is at the heart of our season. This is the middle of our 81st season, and these are the works, these large-scale choral orchestral works, are what the Symphonic Choir was founded 81 years ago to perform. So if you want to experience the Symphonic Choir's raison d'etre, our reason for being, these are the pieces to experience.
Give that webpage one more time so they can get the tickets.
You bet. IndieChoir.org.
That's awesome. Well, Michael Petrie, thank you so much for being my guest today of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. God bless.
Thanks very much.
You have been listening to Faith in Action, the program that looks at how people put their faith into action in their everyday lives. Faith in Action is a presentation of Catholic Radio Indy. You can hear this episode of Faith in Action again or any past episode at CatholicRadioIndy.org. If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future program, please call us at 317-870-8400. Or email Jim at CatholicRadioIndy.org.